The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now.
Hey, we're here. I'm terribly sorry about what's going on. We have complete, total operational incompetence here. Might as well be outside the gates in Kabul trying to do the show. But it's great to have you with us. It's a little more after than it should be. 11 a.m. North American Eastern Time. And that means that it is midday in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes and half past noon in Newfoundland, and 3 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 4 p.m. British Summer Time. It is 7:30 p.m. in Kabul, where there have been two explosions, we believe. And it's in the chaos of these things. Nobody knows yet. They are believed to have been from suicide bombers, one in a sewage trench outside the Abbey Gate at Hamid Karzai International Airport. The death toll is in double figures and includes women and children. But as I said, as I speak, these are the early moments after the blast, and we do not know what the final toll will be. But as we speak, that is the situation in Kabul. You know how this works. You don't have to be a Mark Stein Club member to listen to the show. You can listen to it from anywhere. And we hope that you are listening to it, even in Jalalabad and Herat and Mazar-e-Sharif. But to ask a question, you do have to be a Mark Stein Club member, and we particularly value new club members on our live Q&As. So if you want to give us a shout on that, we'll try and hustle you, just like they do at Abbey Gate at Hamid Karzai International. If you got the right paperwork, we hustle you to the front of the line and through the gate. And that is how it works. Let us get to your questions, because that's what it's all about here. And let's see, what do we got here? We got one from David, who writes, "Hi, Mark. You have described this as America's sewers rather than Saigon moment. What are your predictions about how this plays out over the next year and the longer term? I'm not too familiar with the sewers precedent, other than the fact that this was the first time the UK was on the losing end of a geopolitical power play. But what next? Is sewers really the right analogy here? That was the UK handing the baton to the US. It was orderly. The US was not seeking to destroy the UK. It is clear that China seeks to impose its will on the world and the US. And then there is the level of trade between China and the US. I'm not aware of a precedent in history where there was a transition between two hostile parties that traded extensively with each other. Help us understand how this will play out. Many thanks, David." Well, I said all this. I don't like to get tetchy this early in the show, David. But I did say all this a decade ago in my book, After America, where I actually predicted that there would be a sewers moment. The sewers moment was the moment when America said, screw you, to Britain and France and Israel over the General Nasser in Egypt, General Nasser's seizing of the Suez Canal. And the British and the French and the Israelis both responded all responded militarily. And then Washington decided, Nasser, you know, I don't want to go tunneling back through the centuries for blame. But one of the characteristically stupid foreign policy moves of the CIA was to topple King Farouk and replace him with General Nasser. And you can tell how seriously the CIA thought about this by the name they gave the mission, Operation Fat Bleeper, where bleeper is a word beginning with F. Operation Fat Bleeper, that was the code name for the operation in the CIA. Anyway, Nasser went on to seize the Suez Canal. Washington yanked the rug out from under London and Paris and Israel. And as I said, I forget. Oh, yeah, that's right. I was recalling my long ago conversation with Clarissa Raven, the Countess of Avon. She's still with us at the age of 101. And at that time, she was living in 10 Downing Street as the Mrs. of the British Prime Minister, Anthony Eden. And Lady Avon, about 40, I guess it would be, well, it's decades ago, she and I were talking about something entirely different, the composer Lord Berners, and for some reason, over a cup of tea, we got on to Sewers, and she said for her, it always marked the moment when people still use the term British Empire seriously, and after that, it was just like a sneer and a joke and a punchline. Now, you point out there are certain differences between between the situation of Britain vis-a-vis America and America vis-a-vis China, but those differences don't really matter. The fact that the UK is handing the baton to the US is orderly. That's how the US thinks of China. I quoted, what's he called? One of those big, serious military thinkers. He advised both Bush and Obama, which tells you a lot about why we're as screwed as we are. Kagan, one of those Kagan boys, who said that just as Britain was able to hand off global dominance to America, so America should be able to share it with China. He equivocated a bit. And of course, the comparison is ridiculous. As the Chinese see it, the world is after half a millennium of Euro-American dominance, the world is reverting to the natural way of things. Now, you say, and this isn't entirely true, by the way, David, because key elements in the American establishment were vehemently opposed to British imperialism. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, just to start at the top. But this idea that, this is completely different from Sewers, because back then Britain was ceding power to its great ally, America. Where have you been? I don't want to yell at people this early in the show, but where have you been the last 40 years? Your country has seen China as such an ally that it gave all America's jobs to China. If it thought America was an enemy, why would it have done any of the things it does? Why would it fund the Wuhan Institute of Virology? So you and I and a few other crazy people may think of China as a strategic opponent, a global rival of the United States. But if you look at the actions of every aspect of American life in the last 40 years, clearly all the people who matter in America think exactly of China the way the British thought of America in 1956 as a friendly power to whom it was willingly ceding global dominance because they all look the same way on things. No difference at all. Well, otherwise, why would you give China global dominance in all the computers and computer technology on which modern life runs? Why would you give China global dominance on all the medications on which Americans in particular depend, aspirin upward? Why would you give China global dominance on batteries? Why would you give China global dominance to the point that it becomes the largest surface fleet? Why would you transfer all your manufacturing there? And then when there's actually not a mill left, not a factory left in the lower 48, would you say, well, what else can we? All this new stuff, the knowledge economy, the computer, we'll transfer that. Clearly, David, all the people who matter in America do not see, as this Kagan guy said in his book, and as I mocked him for it a decade ago, you know, no, you're right. The handover of global dominance from the British Empire to from the Pax Britannica to the Pax Americana was one of the smoothest transfers of global dominance in history. And wherever you look around the planet, locally, it became more important in, say, Ottawa and Canberra to get a good hearing in Washington than it did in London. And so, for example, you then had the NORAD air defense, combined air defense between the USAF and the RCAF. You then had in down in the Pacific, you had the ANZUS alliance, Australia, New Zealand, United States. You had British, you had American bases in the British West Indies and in Bermuda. Basically, America just took over Britain's global networks. Well, now you're seeing how it's going to go when it is not a compatible power. You know, America was Britain's prodigal son and the greatest of them all, as prodigal sons can be. And so the prodigal son just took over dear old dad's networks, NORAD, ANZUS, all that kind of stuff. Anyone who, obviously the Chinese thing isn't the same, but the fact is that the morons at the Chamber of Commerce, the corrupt boobs who lead the Republican Party, the Paul Ryans who have sat there, and the Mitt Romneys who have sat there as this has happened, the worst geostrategic calculation in history, to say that, oh, if we just let America, well, we don't really want to make stuff anymore, we'll let the Chinese make it, and in letting them make all our stuff, they'll get more like us. Have you ever heard a more moronic thing? Anyway, David, that's the sewers analogy. That's the sewers analogy. The point is the Chinese, the Wu flu is interesting in that, because when you think about corruption in governments, you assume, for example, that the double agents are all going to be working in the CIA and the NSA and everything. And as we've seen from the revelations of emails, in fact, it can go on in agencies you don't even think of as political, and certainly not as geopolitical, such as the public health agencies. But if you look at all the emails, if you look at Fauci's emails, he's clearly prioritizing, going back to January 2020, he's clearly prioritizing protecting his Chinese friends. And again, as I said, that's the reality. You say, oh, this isn't anything like the intimacy of Britain and America. They just fought side by side in World War II. They were wartime allies. Ike and Monty, they're all big buddies. They'd fought side by side. You know, it's nothing compared to the degree of Sino-American intimacy at the highest levels of American life. And again, there's no equivalent. For example, the NBA, the NBA prioritizes what China wants, which is like test cricket at Lord's or the Oval, prioritizing what America wants in 1956. Hollywood makes films for the Chinese market and is terrified of offending China. There was a certain amount of that in 1956. Yes, it was true that if you were making a film in England at Shepperton, you would like it to be a big hit in the United States. But you weren't terrified of the United States government and in effect giving them a veto over your content. So, David, the point here is that the intimacy, you may not think that the situation between Beijing and Washington is anything like the situation between Washington and London 60 years ago. And you're right. It's actually far more intimate than that. Eric Dale writes, hey, Mark, isn't the debacle in Afghanistan right now what many of our allies, and he puts that in scare quotes, have wanted for years? In the Bush administration, the press delighted in highlighting our unpopularity in European countries, and there are cracks clearly visible in the NATO foundation, with France and Germany being the most vocal. The whole reason Bush assembled a coalition of the willing for Iraq is because there was many an ally unwilling to help. I remember walking around Nantes and Paris and seeing advertisements for documentaries depicting the United States as the human rights violator, not Al-Qaeda or Saddam's regime. This was in 2005. The press changed its tune for Barack Obama, but the underlying polling and opinions of the European public didn't change. The United States was still the evil colonialist empire in their eyes. Don't get me wrong, Biden really fouled things up in Afghanistan, but between Trump wanting to end our forever wars and Biden thinking that he would benefit from the Afghan pullout, our public has turned against foreign intervention. Is this not what much of the world wanted? Well, you're right on that last point, that the domestic politics, as I said a week and a half back, I think actually works for Biden on this. And you can see this in the way, if you look at Twitter and go to any, you know, the big tweeters are saying, wow, Biden has evacuated 70,000 people and not lost one American. This is terrific and all the rest. And in the end, American liberalism is very heartless. It purports to be global and multiculturalism, but it doesn't actually really care. And if you have the misfortune to be taken up by American liberals as one of their pet causes, like blacks, for example, you're screwed. You know, the blacks have been on the Democrat plantation, as we're not allowed to say anymore. Heap big trouble if you say Democrat plantation. But the blacks have been on the Democrat plantation for since the early 1960s, Civil Rights Act, and they're completely screwed. They've got nothing to show for it. The black family life has collapsed and blah, 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 blah. And it's the same thing overseas. You know, they're now talking. They don't care about anybody else. They don't care about allies. They're presenting this as a great triumph for Joe Biden. And because people are sick of the war, bored of the war, checked out of the war a decade ago, the politics of that might well work for him. But the other half of your point, Eric, I don't think is true. Effective liberal interventionism is one of the things that EU types in particular pride themselves on. The French will often, it doesn't even make the papers here, but the French will often send in some paratroopers to deal with some little problem in North Africa or whatever. You never hear about it. Their paratroopers are among the best in the world, do a pretty good job. They like the whole idea of liberal interventionism. And that's why they preferred Afghanistan to Iraq, as wars go. So for them, Afghanistan was the good war. And the way it's ending is not terribly congenial to them. Now, you're right to this degree or another that there are people who like to see America given a bloody nose. And that's what it's getting right now. But even the people who enjoy seeing America get a bloody nose give some thought to what follows. And the fact is that all, as we've just been talking about with China, all the things that are going to follow the implosion of American global power are worse. Now, how bad they'll be, that remains to be seen. My own view, I think, is that we're heading into one of the darkest periods for the world of the last half, certainly of the last half millennium. I think it's going to be absolutely horrible. But no, I don't think. I think if you just track some of the globe, turn off the American coverage because it's mostly rubbish of what's going on in Afghanistan, and just look at the BBC or Deutsche Welle or the French or whatever you happen to fancy, and you will see on these European networks that actually the outrage at what is a massive is a defeat, not just for the American hyperpower, but for European ideas of liberal interventionism. No, they're pretty genuinely upset about this. And again, it's the parochialism of American coverage which is disturbing, because I don't think most Americans know that, for example, at the time of that Bagram pullout, as I mentioned yesterday, 3/4 of the NATO troops, it's a NATO mission, NATO's an American-led alliance, so the guy in charge is one of these useless American generals, but 3/4 of the troops there were from countries other than America. They're all there, and they were proud of their record, and they're having to, and they wake up one morning and the Americans have fled. And they don't know what's going on. So the guy leading the operation has buggered off. He's flown the coop. And you didn't get a heads up on this. And so it's nothing to do with, oh, they're pleased because America's been given a bloody nose. No, they're furious. And all you hear now, I mean, in Britain and Germany and a couple of other places, they're actually saying this in public. Let's not go to war with America again, because we just got screwed. Have you ever heard of a thing? Go back to what, you know, as I said, there's a certain element of parochialism that one accepts because America is the biggest power on the planet. But D-Day, say, there were 5 Normandy beaches. The Americans got 2 and the British Commonwealth got 3, which is a practical matter. Boil down to 2 UK and 1 Canadian beach, Juno, and then with Australians, whatever, doing other stuff there. So anyway, 2 American beaches, 3 British beaches. And so let's say the UK, Canada, all land on those 3 other beaches, and they happen to click on their smartphones and see that on CNN, CNN's reporting that Eisenhower changed his mind. He set foot on Normandy, didn't like the look of it, and he's packed up and cleared off. Right? Allies don't do that. There's a NATO mission in which the United States did not actually inform the NATO members that it was pulling out. There's nothing like this. And nothing about, seeing US neocolonialism collapse compensates for the shock of that. You just imagine it. Just imagine it. And this guy who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or whatever you call it, this guy thoroughly modern Milley. Huh? You can't do something like that without knowing exactly what it is you're doing. Toby Pilling says, the much-scorned Afghan National Army collapsed and fled. Regardless of whether it was trained to only act with air support, wouldn't a battalion or two of Afghan women soldiers have fought better, like the Kurds or Israelis? At least they'd have had something to fight for. The Afghan National Army was a joke. But it was actually a very American joke in that respect, because the Pentagon constructed an army in its own image. An army, they were lavishly paid, which means they were overpaid by the standards of Afghanistan. So, in other words, it attracted people who didn't want to be soldiers. It attracted people who wanted to make more dough than being a goat herd. Then it was heavily dependent on huge staff and staff support and air support. And you take those away and you train someone to fight in a kind of warfare that no longer exists because you left. I don't know what I would do. I would say, but I've said my say on Afghanistan. I think they should have put the king back on his throne, because the king was the only unifying figure in Afghanistan. Everything else is tribal. And secondly, I think they should have constructed those armies tribally. You know, there's this idea, if you believe the bollocks about diversity, actually many military units, many ancient regiments, in Canada, the Van Dues, the so-called the Quebec regiment that is a de facto francophone regiment. You have occasional Anglos in there, but it's understood that it's a francophone regiment because Quebecers like Quebecers, and it doesn't do anything for cohesion if you've got an Albertan or a Manitoban in there. And that's Canada. That's before you start looking at the British Army and the Scots and Irish and Welsh regiments. The army should have been built regionally and in effect tribally in Afghanistan. But there's no point. There's no point arguing about this because it's all been screwed. It's all been screwed. And as I said, to go back to the big point, you know, we can all do cluster bleep Kirby, the guy who gives the Pentagon briefings and says he doesn't want to do Monday morning quarterbacking. I don't particularly want to do that either. The fact is, it's a tragedy if you happen to be a woman in Afghanistan. But if you're not a woman in Afghanistan, it's mainly a tragedy for America. And blaming that on the Afghan, you know. Who should have known the Afghan National Army is a mirage? Wouldn't you think the guys who trained them do that? And again, Toby, that gets to the point. They lied to us. The Pentagon lied to us about Afghanistan for a good decade and a half. It lied to us about what was going on there because, like everything else in the swamp, it just became a racket. Midwestern Tim, it's a bit of a cranky show today. I apologize for my crankiness. Midwestern Tim says, where will Western culture go to be preserved? He's thinking, he's in a Benedictine mood. Pope Benedict, the Pope Emeritus, as he is rather ludicrously known, Pope Benedict chose his name because he thought we were at a Benedictine moment. And he identified with the Pope who preserved the glories of civilization as we entered the Dark Age. And so Midwestern Tim is really being a bit of a Midwestern Benedict today, saying, where will Western culture go to be preserved? Are there any druids or monks in some far-flung country willing to keep the literature, music, thought, and traditions alive while the plague of modernity is waging its onslaught? Are there any leaders today with the balls to preserve the civilization that built the modern world, or are we doomed to go the way of those last few unlucky Westerners stuck at the Kabul airport? Are the cruise ships moored just off the shore, waiting to offload their passengers? Yes, I think about this. I think about this quite a lot because, as you know, we do a lot of ad hoc cultural preservation work here at this website. We talk about music and poetry and history and things that nobody ever talks about. And one of the reasons I do that is because one of the anomalies of the internet age is that, although, I mean, for example, sewers, you know, I don't know much about sewers. Stein keeps talking about the sewers moment, and I don't really know what that means, so it's not helpful to me. Well, you know, if 30 years ago, if I'd said the sewers moment and you didn't know what it meant, you'd have had to walk out of your house, walk 2 miles down the road to the town library, then discover that it's closed on Thursdays, walk 2 miles back, and then walk out back out there the Friday to go and look it up in a book, what the sewers moment means. Now you can actually do it in 45 seconds, and incredibly, we seem to have raised the generation or two of people who can't even be bothered to take 45 seconds, whereas 30 years ago, there would have been people who'd have walked out the house, down the road to the town library and looked it up and then walked back. So we are in a strange situation where, in theory, the entirety of human knowledge is a click away. But Increasingly, those cliques are under the control of a handful of woke billionaires who want to restrict access, who see themselves in the knowledge restricting business. And increasingly, too, we have actually rewired mankind out of the curiosity business. I mean, what is interesting to me about young people, for example, who the children are our future, as Bill Clinton always used to say. What is interesting about that is that with a natural contrarian streak of youth comes curiosity. Youth always used to be naturally contrarian. I remember when I was at school, we had a 19th century school song. Never mind the cheers and hooting, keep your head and play the game. It was took essentially the Duke of Wellington's view that the sporting virtues were that you learnt on the field of sporting combat enabled you to overcome the natives when you were on some thankless bit of sod like Afghanistan. And so, of course, we being young and rebellious, said, you're not interested in all this imperialist twaddle. This school song sucks. We want no part of it. And instead, the chief master made us sing it because he wasn't interested in our contrarian view of that 19th century imperialist school song. Then we got he retired, and we got some trendy chief master who had who basically agreed with our take on the school. So he thought it was imperialist twaddle. So he banned us from singing. He banned the singing of the school song. And so at that point, morning service and at the service at the end of school and everything, we all made a point of defying him and rising up and singing the imperialist school song that we had reviled just a couple of years earlier. Never mind the cheers and hooting, keep your head and play the game. And the point I'm making there is you rely on the contrarian streak, the contrarian streak of youth. And what's interesting to me, Tim, is the way that has actually been totally extinguished. And now people are actually told, oh, yes, no, we shouldn't even be talking about transgender issues or climate denial because it might trigger me. And the contrarian streak of youth is nowhere to be seen. That's why you see those, the fawning, the non-comedy comedy, where a so-called comedian instead invites a woke audience just to applaud the correctness of their attitudes. So the things we rely on for a kind of cultural dynamism have absolutely gone. And I think you basically ask that where will Western culture go to be preserved? And I take it you'd really like me to come up with an answer that says, the Netherlands or New Zealand or, somewhere identifiable. And I don't think it's going to be like that. I think right now it's the countries of Middle Europa and a little bit of ways east, although obviously once you get to Belarus, it all gets a bit more iffy. But if you go to the countries of Middle Europa, I think they are serious about defending their civilizational inheritance, which in large part includes ours. And we're not. So if you want to think in Benedictine ways and you want to think about all this stuff that in theory is accessible to all 7 billion people on the planet once they pick up a laptop or a telephone, and in fact, it's not, because there's a sort of virtual statue toppling going on, then I think it's actually going to be, the West gets less West the more West it goes. And basically, the West is moving East. And in the immediate future, it'll be those nations that we have to look on. Larry Davis says, "Hi, Mark. I consider you a futurist, as so many of your predictions are now a reality. You say China has already won. I agree. What will our world be like now that they run it?" Thank you, Larry. I think I did a little bit of this in After America, too. Because in a certain sense, we're all Hong Kong now. We are all Hong Kong. Where the Chinese are giving us kind of assurances that, oh, don't you worry, it'll be one world, two systems. I think there was actually some bozo, what was he? He was some CEO or whatever, and he was actually, he actually used that phrase unironically. That was supposed to be the Sino-British agreement on Hong Kong, that it would be one country but two systems, which it largely was until 2020. And then China simply tore up that agreement and paid no price. And so Hong Kong is increasingly indistinguishable from mainland China. And I think that's actually the way it's going to go here. There will be lip service paid to one world, two systems. But China, as we have seen, is actually extremely aggressive anywhere around the world about protecting itself from any criticism. As you know, if someone in Australia criticizes the Chinese go bananas and take all kinds of action against Australia. Now, I think what I said in After America is that you will still see, there will still be fellows, you know, called Jeremy, who are flying around the world and purporting to be important. But as I said in After America, increasingly they're going, it's simply a Jeremy front for what is essentially a Chinese operation. So the Chinese know enough to know that they'll, you know, the spokesman for this or that will be fellows with public school ties, and pasty white faces and all the rest of it. There's gonna be an element to that because they're quite clever about those kind of things. You see that already, though. You look at the WHO isn't headed by some fella from Beijing. It's headed by a sock puppet from Ethiopia, because the Chinese think that's a cuter way to do things. And likewise, at the American end of things, it isn't a sinister Oriental telling you to wear a mask in Washington. It's Fauci. But Fauci and that other guy, Peter Daszak, have been wholly compromised and wholly bought. So what you're going to see is the purchase of more and more areas of life. Secondly, I think one thing you'll see about this, Larry, is that the Chinese, you sort of see this already if you look at the airlines. If you look at, say, the Oriental Airlines, the gap in the innovation in terms of, you know, these like first class seating arrangements and everything. I mean, there hasn't been a new idea in American airlines for, you know, half a century now. But these, the innovations that you see in the Chinese in the Chinese airlines, and indeed in the from the Emirates and those kinds of places, I think there's going to be more of that. That the comfort, the elite comforts, in an Eastern life, the gap between that and the sort of crappiness of Delta, or the crappiness of these other North American airlines, the gap will open up so that elite persons wishing to lead an elite life will naturally gravitate Chinawards. That's happened already. If you listen to what anybody who matters in America, particularly, but to and also in Australia, New Zealand, not so much in Western Europe, but basically they figured China has already won, and you want to be with the winning side, and the winning side will have increasingly greater comforts of life. And the decrepitude, I think the decrepitude will settle on America a lot faster than people think, because what we're waiting for now is what's propping America up? What props America up? As I said, in After America. After America isn't a bad book, by the way. You know, a lot of people didn't like it at the time, but if you read it, it gets a lot of these things dead right. And one of them was the thing that also came in the Suez moment, when Washington yanked the rug out from under the pound. All that's holding America up is the fact that the dollar is the global currency, and at one moment, China is going to just yank the rug out from that. And after Afghanistan, is it going to come sooner rather than later? Well, you know, you don't have to be on the Politburo to recognize that it's going to come sooner. Drew Weber writes, Mark, emotion rather than objectivity overwhelmingly drives our politics. This is right, Drew. This is right. I think it's that Ben Shapiro line where his line is, your feelings don't trump my facts, or whatever it is. That's wrong. That's as wrong as any political bromide can be. The fact is that on everything that matters, climate change, illegal immigration, COVID, feelings trump facts, because we live in a world of stories, and the right doesn't have any appealing stories. The right just has these cold, hard facts that can't withstand the mush of emotions and the mush of feelings. So that's an excellent point, Drew. Well put. Drew says, emotion rather than objectivity overwhelmingly drives our politics. The dialogue on the open borders focuses on humanitarian crises rather than national sovereignty and well-being of US citizens. Yes. In Afghanistan, the Biden administration is relying on a single metric, the number of people who can get out. Surely an immediate and emotional factor in this debacle. However, this ignores the impact, whatever may be left of US leadership and credibility, and security issues of weapons left behind and resurgence of terrorist elements. Whether 80% or 99%, Biden will claim success and the mainstream media will run with the narrative. Domestic policy is also largely driven by emotional appeals. Can a democracy survive this way? Well, it can. Drew, it can survive because in the old days, stories, again, it's about stories, it's about narrative, it's about emotion. Now, the emotions that used to stir the blood in most places were the ones we know. You still see them in the movies, you know, Mel Gibson being all daubed in his blue face and all the rest of it, that's in there because that would stir the blood at most societies in most of human history. We don't want to fight, but by jingo, if we do, we've got the men, we've got the ships, we've got the money too. We fought the bear before, and while we're Britain's true, the Russians shall not have Constantinople. That's emotion. That's the narrative. But the thing is, we've changed the nature of stories. We've changed, so all societies depend on the stories they tell themselves. The difference is we tell ourselves stories that are crap, complete and utter crap. And that is why it's, and this is actually critical to why Republicans mostly lose. Conservative parties, you know, in Canada, for example, it looks as if, despite the fact they have a totally incompetent leader, Justin's campaign has got off to a wobbly start, and thus a totally incompetent Tory party leader might actually think that the chips might fall his way, and he might actually find himself as prime minister in a couple of weeks. But is he going to do anything? Will it make any difference? Or it will just be another placeholder Conservative government, such as Mr. Harper's proved for the most part? And you've got to figure that's the way to bet, because you can't have genuinely conservative government in a liberal culture. And when all the stories that we tell ourselves are nonsense, so that if you hear about, we've lost control of the southern border and there are 250,000 people who we don't know of, we don't know who they are, they have a COVID positivity rate 3 times that of the general population, and we're flying them all over the country and putting them up in hotels in the centre of your town, and that's going to be a big super spread. You know, the public don't hear that. The public hear, oh, look, heartwarming, all they want. And all your prominent Republicans talk about them like that. Oh, yes, they're, you know, family values don't stop at the Rio Grande. No, America stops at the Rio Grande. As Drew says, national sovereignty. America stops at the Rio Grande. And so once upon a time, defending America would have been the emotional bit, would have been the story. Not, oh, look at all these sex slaving gangs. Child sex slaving gang. Look at all these heartwarming MS-13. Glenn Beck, people say to me, why are you off the reservation with Conservatism Inc.? You know, I never had anything against Glenn Beck until he sued me, to be honest. That was what did it for me. But before that, I think I mocked him on Rush for this at one point. You know, when there was another big rush at the border and the squish Republicans, the McCains and the Lindsey Grahams and all the rest of them, were going to do one of these comprehensive immigration deals whereby everybody gets amnesty. But don't worry, we're going to have border enforcement 8, 9, 10, 20, 37 years down the road. And Glenn Beck was so choked up about all these heartwarming MS-13 gang members coming across the Rio Grande to start macheteing people in Long Island. His heart was so touched by this heartwarming narrative that he organized some campaign to take children's toys down there. Because he'd been watching Katie Couric or whoever it was then, and Katie had said, these are children coming across the border, she means 17-year-old MS-13 members. So he got his listeners, the number two conservative radio show in the country, I think, at that time. Number three, let's all send teddy bears. And then he went down to the border to hand out teddy bears to gangbangers. Teddy bears for gangbangers. I said that on Rush at the time, and I got told that we conservatives are all meant to stick together. But I think when a conservative is organising teddy bears for gangbangers, and I said this is before he sued me, there's nothing personal about it, I think you should be able to point it out. But that's the thing. That's a stupid narrative. That's a stupid story. That's stupid emotion. Teddy bears for gangbangers. We need to tell stories. And this is why the schools are important, because the stories used to be about, our storytelling used to be about nation and pride in our nation and the great historical narrative. Now we teach our children that the nation's crap, the nation's evil. The nation is a nation built on the blood of slaves and all the rest of it. And I was sort of going to get into the great national story. That was going to be my story. I like the storytelling about how great our nation was. But you've just now said the nation is total crap. So what else have you got? Oh, well, we've got transgender sporting accomplishment. How about the emotional appeal of that? If you destroy the normal narratives of functioning societies and you put in place these idiotic ones, don't be surprised when the whole joint goes belly up. Robert Fox says, Mark, the US pullout from Afghanistan was bungled so badly and handled so incompetently that it had to be intentional. Was this done by the White House to give the swerve to the media, pundits and public to provide a smokescreen for some other shenanigans they may be pulling? Robert, I guess what you're saying is that the US bungled the Afghan pullout in order that we'd all talk about Afghanistan. And in the meantime, they'd release things like the FBI saying there was no real conspiracy on January the 6th. Everybody, including this current stupid investigation by Nancy Pelosi, has been done on the assumption that January the 6th was some kind of great conspiracy. So everything goes south in Afghanistan, and we all talk about Afghanistan, and nobody notices the FBI putting out this thing saying there was no conspiracy. Or the, you know, the vote audits going on in various parts of the country, and in order that there be no attention paid to them, or, you know, the MyPillow guys, cyber forum or whatever. No, I think sometimes the event is the event. And I think it's right that it was an intentional fiasco, which itself is very interesting. But I think the event itself is what was done as to teach us something. Don't forget that Joe Biden has always been a boob on foreign policy, even when he had his marbles. But right now he's a sock puppet controlled by an uber woke administration. A lot of people who worked in, for example, the Obama administration. And people who do not, I never like to go down this road unless it's necessary, but I don't think it's impossible to look at orthodoxy on the left without concluding that that orthodoxy could not be what it is if these people didn't hate their country. I mean, they're very different, for example, from, you know, I mean, what example do you want to pick? I mean, you can pick French socialists who still love France. You can pick old British Labour Party, working class Northern Labour Party types who've all been basically banned and have gone over to Boris in the last election. But those old Labour Party loved their country like the French socialists love their country. When you're governed by people who hate their country, this to them is the way of, you know, you think if you're Ilhan Omar, who has an outsized influence in the Democrat Party, the 20-year war on terror began when somebody did something or whatever it was she said. And the best way to do that, the best way to stop this kind of American geopolitical adventuring is to actually hand the Taliban a victory, delayed a little. You know, Osama bin Laden and Mullah Omar took out the Twin Towers in order to draw America into Afghanistan and into war. Because as they see it, they'd beaten the last global superpower, the Soviet Union, and they'd like to actually beat the other one, and then they'd have a full set for their trophy room. And thanks to what Joe Biden did, they pulled that off. To be sure, it took a little longer than Osama and Mullah Omar had intended, but basically they pulled that off. And it was Joe Biden's, to reprise the line I used on last Friday's Mark Stein show, who are these guys working for? Who are these guys working for? So I agree it was intentional, but I agree it's not, you know, it's not done to cover up this or cover up that. It's not a smokescreen. You're looking at America, and again, this is where listening to American talk radio, I mean, I listened to, I think it was one of these, you know, Replacements for Rush. If you don't like the Replacement for Rush, there'll be a new one along any minute. But one of those was like going, what's your favorite superhero? This goes back to emotions, right? We're talking about emotions. What's your favorite superhero? Real men don't have superheroes. There are no superheroes. There are no guys in long underwear flying around in the sky. There are only heroes. And the more superheroes you have, the fewer heroes, flesh and blood heroes. Not in candy-coloured long underwear, but just in regular clothes, in a shirt and pants and a sport coat and whatever. And so there's nothing conservative about asking a conservative audience, what's your favourite superhero? Because actually the fact that that's our preferred form of storytelling is one reason we're screwed. But I do agree with you on that, that this was intentional, to actually kill the 21st century war on terror, to kill it stone dead by handing a victory to the guys who started it. Larry Durham said, I have to admit that I felt a little panic myself when daylight hit the vein. This is a reference to Tale for Our Time, which wrapped up last night, Jack London's Burning Daylight. However, like daylight, I have a good plot, a beautiful garden, and an exquisite little woman to keep me grounded in the ever-mending world. Thank you for your fabulous reading of this relevant tale. So with all that, do you have a tease for the next installment of Tales for Our Time? No, I don't. I'm not going to do a tease, because I take that question that came from Drew seriously. I take it very seriously, that the Raymond Arroyo, who is like Laura Ingraham's sidekick on Fox News, and Raymond was a guest when I was hosting Fox News Primetime a couple of weeks ago. And Raymond had wanted to come on because he had this particular thesis that because the left controls all the emotional narratives, the ones that touch your heart, the ones that go to your heart. And I brought up that Ben Shapiro line when he said, your feelings don't trump my facts. And the fact is they do on every subject that matters. And the opposite is true, is that to most Americans right now, your facts don't trump their feelings. And unless we come up with some serious way of actually finding this is why, another reason why I say, don't wave your constitution at me. You've got all the constitutional conservatives. Everyone who likes Mark Levin conservatism is already on board. That's not what national feeling is. It's more than that. It's beyond, most nation states are beyond rationalism. Because if you were thinking hyper-rationally, there would be no Liechtenstein, just to take the most obvious example. So it's not enough. It's not enough. And I'm surprised at how few conservatives get that. Scott Scherzer says, dear Mark, I'm surprised at the way the mainstream media has been covering the Afghanistan fiasco. Why do you suppose they haven't given Biden a pass, as they have with all his other screw-ups? Will the negative coverage last, or will they soon find a way to blame Trump for this disaster? And regarding the bigger picture, how long have I got before learning to speak Mandarin? Sincerely, Scott Scherzer of Miami Beach. Is it true that they're not giving? I mean, I notice a lot of people, who seem to think that Jen Psaki owns Peter Doocy every day. I don't see how you could. I think Jen Psaki is ridiculous. But I think the American media coverage, as I said, it's been so parochial that they think in storytelling terms. So it's like the perils of Pauline. How will Pauline Biden get out of this? And there's our plucky heroine hanging by her fingernails from the cliff edge. And we see these terrible, pitiful scenes of Biden peering woozily into the teleprompter and muttering these lines whose meaning he doesn't seem to understand, and then he totters off. And you couldn't actually ask for a better projection of American weakness, of American nothingness. It's like physically embodied in him. But the way the media are setting it up, I think, is that sort of roundabout, assuming nothing else is untoward, like these two bombs at the airport, that you will then see the media narrative start to shift, and you will have, and they will say, oh, he did a marvelous job. Yes, of course, it could have been a lot better organized, but the way they were able to swivel on a dime and get the biggest airlift of all time out of Kabul, it's just, they're not seriously interested. They are responsible for this moment. He's not the president. He's a dead man. Where Brezhnev? He's Brezhnev, and where the late phase Soviet Union, where the chairman of the Politburo is dead, but we all agree to prop him up at the podium to review all the tanks on May Day, and Pravda and Izvestia agree to pretend that he's not dead. So the waxwork is leaning there on the podium, and we all say he's doing a splendid. That's what the media have been doing for 8 months. And then something comes along, and it's not possible to pretend he's dead anymore. So we then identify the next guy, Chernenko, and Dropov. Andropov we pick because he's into the American pop culture. He used to like Glenn Miller. Which they didn't get in Moscow until like 15 years after the war. So then we pretend that Andropov is alive, and we prop him up, and he's listening to the Glenn Miller and having a grand old time. We're now at that phase. We've got a dead man. And we're all pretending to be president. And the media have pretended that he's president. And they're going to carry on pretending that he's president. And as to how long you've got before learning to speak Mandarin, you may have left it a little late. The Chinese, of all the Western Mandarin speakers, I'm astonished at the number of people. What's her name? Rosamund Pike. Did you see Rosamund Pike? She was the Bond girl in Die Another Day. I think that was her first movie. And then she was in Gone Girl a couple of years ago. And she was really very good in that. She is a fine actress. She and her husband have raised their kids. They've given their kids Mandarin names, and the kids are, I don't know what age the kids are, 5, 7, whatever, but they already speak Mandarin. You see what I mean? It's like if you're in one of those industries that spends a lot of time kissing up to China. Here's the thing. Just to round things out on a biggish thought. I remember talking about this in The Spectator back in the 90s. The French loathed all this talk about globalization because they said, in effect, globalization means Americanization. We're all eating cheeseburgers, listening to rap, and watching Hollywood car chases. And that seemed fairly obvious then. That seemed fairly obvious, an obvious thing to say. The French critique that globalization is just a euphemism for Americanization. And the Chinese are always one step ahead, because what Chairman Xi and his pals on the Politburo figured out is that Americanization is, in fact, the euphemism. And what it is, the euphemism for is Chinese control, so that things that we think of as all American, like boring sports like the NBA, and boring movies like all the shoot 'em ups and Fast and Furious 27 and Iron Man 43, these things are all which seem to be the most American, that can't get more American than Iron Man 43, can't get more American than the NBA. No. They're Chinese fronts. They're way better than the old Soviet fronts and the old Nazi fronts. They're extremely effective Chinese fronts. That's the madness of the world we live in. Thank you so much for all your questions. I should say, what time are we now? That in about 4 hours' time, I think at 9 p.m. British Summer Time, I will be on 7-8 Radio for the encore presentation of our Song of the Week. If you heard it on Sunday, you'll know it's a good one, and that people seem to especially like that show and to find it especially touching. And if you missed it, you can hear it again in about 4 hours' time. We will have one of our lookbacks to the summer of 2001. I didn't intend this to be a bookend series, but we're closing out the War on Terror with The Way We Came in the summer of 2001. And of course, over the weekend, if you haven't already seen Tal Bachman's great remembrance of Charlie Watts, the Rolling Stones drummer, a very dapper man, a jazz man. The only encounter I ever had with him was in Ronnie Scott's. I have a slight acquaintance with one of his players in one of his jazz combos. But Tal wrote a terrific piece about him, which I hope you'll read. And we will have all our other things, all our other Stein Online regulars coming up for you in the next few days. The lights never go out here. As Sir Edward Grey said, the lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetimes. The lamps are going out all over Afghanistan and over so many citadels of the West too. But here at Stein Online, the lights stay on. Thank you so much for joining us today. And we will see you next time on our Clubland Q&A.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.
There is no verse to this song, 'cause I don't want to wait a moment too long to say that I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone. Get you and keep you in my arms evermore. Leave all your lovers weeping on the faraway shore, out on the briny where the moon big and shiny melting your heart as stone. I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone. Oh, come on, Jessica. What do you say?
Well, you know, Mark, I have got a business meeting in Shanghai. Maybe if we booked a junk round the Cape of Good Hope, I could do some teleconferencing from the bilge pump.
Ah, the romance of the seas. I'm gonna get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone.
A twist in the rudder and a rip in the sail, drifting and dreaming.
Toss the cell phone over the rail,
out on the briny,
just Jess
and Mark Steiny.
I'll be melting your heart of stone.
I'm gonna love you on that slow boat to China.
just me and Miss Martin.
You'll be melting my heart of stone.
I'd love to get you on a slow boat to China.
All to myself.
Off the continental shelf. All